Okay, good morning. I'm really very happy and very honored to be part of this event. I think it's a really great event for the region here, for San Diego, and for stem cell research. Now, clearly what we just heard, that the mission is to eventually develop therapies for diseases, and I think that's a realistic goal. But I think we have to be aware. There are a number of issues which need to be improved or resolved, and I thought I'd just concentrate on those. So the promise, obviously, of stem cell research is to that we can generate any cell type of the body in culture, and this, of course, could be used for to treating diseases. So the eventually goal is to use the potential of pluripotent cells to generate cells which are customized for the treatment of patients with degenerative diseases. So that's the final goal. So let me just go a little bit back. What I learned still in school was development is unidirectional from a pluripotent cell to a differentiated cell. But what Dolly taught us, it can be reversed. And I'm sure Ian Wilmuth will... And I think that was such an important finding, which said that the nuclei of differentiated cells maintain the potential to generate an entire organism. I think that is the basis for much what we're doing, and you surely will hear more about this in this afternoon. Putting stem cells and nuclear transfer together, we come to the concept of therapeutic cloning, which was a rather controversial issue in the 90s. It was a way to make customized cells, but it was very controversial because you would need human eggs, and there were a lot of objections. And I just want to briefly review this, we did a proof-of-principle experiment in mice now almost 10 years ago where the patient was a mouse with a severe immune deficiency. These mice don't have any B and T cells due to the mutation of this gene, and the experiment was then to take a skin cell from these mice, do nuclear transfer, generate a clone blastocyst, then a clone embryonic stem cell, use simple gene correction to correct one of the two alleles, then differentiate the cells to bone marrow stem cells, put them back into the mouse, and this restore the immune system. So therapeutic cloning works in mammals. But of course, if you use a human here, this is just not an option, because as we know, it doesn't work in humans. Nuclear transfer so far has not worked. The details have not been worked out. So the only option was to do it without eggs. And this, of course, was then the beginning of the iPS technology by Shinya Yamanaka now 5 years ago, which launched a revolution in the field, an enormous expansion. So I will not go really into any mechanistic how we do this. I'd rather concentrate on the issues which we are facing and we want to apply that. So what's the goal? The goal is to study human diseases in the petri dish. I think that is probably the nearest goal we can think about. And then eventually use such a system to find a drug which might affect the phenotype which we might see in culture. And eventually to do cell therapy. And I think this is further away. One should be not too promise too much that it is around the corner, I think. The number of complicating issues when we work with human pluripotent cells, because human embryonic stem cells are not like mouse embryonic stem cells. In mouse, we can do anything. It's very simple. In human cells, we cannot. They grow rather slow. They don't like to be a single cells. You have to pathogen mechanically to avoid chromosomal aberrations. That is very labor-intensive, and they have a low efficiency of homologous recombination. So the idea would be, obviously, to use such a system for disease modeling, and I think that, as I said, is probably the proximal goal, and then eventually to use it for cell therapy. So what are the key questions which we have to think about? So the mechanism, I'm not going to talk about this. It's very interesting. A lot of people work on this to make it more efficient. I will not really touch on this. But I think I want to. One question would be, what is a good iPS cell? What is a good ES cell? Can we define those? I think that's an important issue. We'll come to this. We have to make iPS cells which are not genetically modified. Gene targeting is a major issue, which has been very inefficient. And then I think the most important issue is, can we see a disease-relevant phenotype in the culture dish? And what is the appropriate control when we do experiments? So these are the four issues I want to really address. So human ES cells are generated by the Jamie Thompson protocol, a very robust protocol established in the 90s. And it uses growth embryos to grow in FGF and activin, but not LIF. LIF is the cytokine which is important for most ES cells. Which raises the question, which I want to raise now, what is the grown state of pluripotency, and is it realized in the conventional human ES cells or iPS cells we have? So let me just come. Pluripotent cells can be generated from the inner cell mass, as in mouse, the classical mouse ES cells, or from the implanted embryo. These are called epiSC cells or epiblast stem cells. Both of these cells are pluripotent, but they're actually quite different. So let me contrast these. So in mouse, we can generate ES cells from the blastocyst or iPS cells from somatic cells, or we can generate epiSC cells from the implanted embryo, from the epiblast. In human, ES cells are generated from the blastocyst and iPS cells from somatic cells. But actually, these cell types are very different. Mouse are small cells, dense colonies, whereas epiSCs in human are very similar. They're flat colonies. They use different signaling pathways, LIF for mouse, basically FGF and activin for epiSCs in human. Gene targeting is very inefficient here. It's very efficient in mouse, but very inefficient in these two types of cells. Exon activation, it's a very important epigenetic event. These cells are pre-exon activation. Both exons are active. Those are post-exon activation. They have already undergone exon activation. And Austin Smith has called this state of pluripotency the primed state. And this is the naive state, implying that the prime state is less immature than the naive state. It's more along differentiation. I want to come a little back to exon activation. So there are different states of pluripotency. The naive state, which is unlike the prime state, which is the one characterized by epiSC cells and human ES cells. Can we convert these states? And indeed we can. That's work by Austin Smith. He has shown it for mouse. And what he showed was when you culture naive cells in the presence of FGF activin, they convert to the prime state. If you do it with some other tricks under different conditions, with two eye conditions, which I come to, and LIF, they convert back. So they're two different states. They seem to be stable. Can we convert human cells to the naive state? And this was work which was done in my laboratory by Jakob Hanna, a terrific postdoc, and Chris Saha. So what he used was, and let me briefly go through the system. What he used was a system, what we call human primary fibroblasts. These are fibroblasts which were infected with the doxycycline-inducible viruses which induce iPS cells. So you can make what we call primary human iPS cells. You withdraw dox, so you inactivate these viruses, and then you differentiate these cells in vitro or in vivo, and you make what we call secondary fibroblast cells. Now, they carry now the viruses integrated in an inducible form, which led to iPS cells in the first place. Now you can just give doxycycline to those, and you get what we call secondary human iPS cells. The key of this exercise is you don't need any new viral infection. It's rather efficient. So it's just a technical issue. So that's what Jakob Hanna used. So he used these secondary fibroblasts, which carry these four Yamanaka factors in a doxycycline-inducible way, and activated those with doxycycline and added some factors. These are some inhibitors of the ERK pathway and the GSK3 beta. These are the two eye conditions of Austin Smith and LIF. And what he saw was rather interesting. This is the starting cells, flat, typical colonies. And after 5 days, you see that change. And then after many passages, they really look like mouse ES cells, which was very surprising. And coming back to X inactivation, as you know, X inactivation occurs by activation of the exist gene on the inactive X, which codes the whole inactive X. And you can see in the undifferentiated cells, you see two small signals from each X chromosome. After differentiation, you see the bar body here, which is coded by the exist RNA, and the active X has turned off exist. In human, you would start here. You never see this. That's in the conventional human cells. So when Jakob looked at the human cells, in the starting, every cell expresses exist. They have undergone X inactivation. But once you convert them, none of the cells expresses exist. And when you differentiate these cells, they re-express exist. So they really look like most yes cells. They reactivated the inactive X. And when you look at gene expression, then you find that these converted, we call them naive human ES cells now, they're very different from the conventional human ES cells or iPS cells. And they're actually very close to the mouse naive ES cells. So it's a different state, the one I want to come to, a different state of pluripotency in human cells, which resembles the mouse cells, and it's very different from the EPSC cells and the conventional human ES cells, which are close together, clustered together. So why do we think that's important? Well, in mouse, we can compare these two states quite well. So the naive classical mouse ES cells have a high proliferation rate, high cloning efficiency in contrast to the EPSC cells, high gene targeting, their pre-X inactivation or their post. Those can make chimeras, those cannot. So they're somewhat different in their pluripotency state. The converted human naive cells resemble in many, many of these properties the most naive cells. They have a higher proliferation rate than the starting cells, high cloning efficiency, we don't know about gene targeting, they have reactivated the X, and it's known that these cells cannot make chimeras. So what the issue is, which we are interested in, is if we can, is that a different state of pluripotency which would facilitate working with these cells in terms of gene targeting, differentiation protocol, coming back to the question, what is a ground state? I think we don't know this yet. So let me come to some key issues, namely genetic and epigenetic difference between ES cells and iPS cells. And it's known the difference between ES cells and ES cells, between ES cells and iPS cells, and between iPS cells and iPS cells. This actually is a rather important, I think it's a serious issue when you want to use patient-specific cells and control cells because they might be different because of the system. So you're comparing apples with oranges in the worst case. And I'll just give you now a few examples of many of the data which came up to argue that there are differences between genetic and epigenetic properties between ES cells and iPS cells. I think we don't know yet how functionally significant those are, and there's quite a lot of, I think, it's important to define. So what could these differences be due to? For iPS cells, which I'm going to concentrate on, is each iPS is different from the other because they have different viral integrations and they're conventionally made. That could lead to a different stoichiometry of factor expression. The genetic background of the cells is different, and the conditions how they were derived. I want to concentrate on this, on the stoichiometry. And this was an important paper which came out last year from Conrado Ehlinger's laboratory, who argued that iPS cells are different from ES cells because they lose imprinting at a very specific locus. And so the key conclusions from his paper were that in 95% of iPS cells, they lost imprinting at this particular locus, and this was not seen in ES cells. But this correlated with significantly reduced potential to generate chimeras, and none of these loss of imprinting iPS cells were able to generate all iPS cells, which is the most stringent test for pluripotency, which I will come to and define in a minute. So there was a strong correlation of loss of imprinting and reduced pluripotency. The paper was so strong because it used a very well-defined system. What he did was he inserted a vector, a polycystronic vector, encoding all four factors into a locus, the collagen locus, in the mouse. And this was activated by the transactivator, TEDOC operator, driven is a transgene, which was inserted into another locus. So there were transgenic strains. You could then take any somatic cell you want, give doxycycline, this is a secondary system basically, just better, and isolate isogenic iPS cells, which you know can inject into a blastocyst to make chimeras, or into a tetraploid blastocyst to make all iPS mice. The tetraploid host cells cannot give rise to the embryo proper, so you really make only iPS cells are forced to make the whole mouse. There's no help from the host, so that's why it's the most stringent assay. So the different iPS cells are isogenic. They have identical transgenes. Of course, they're coming from this transgenic system here. And they have an identical stoichiometry of factor expression. Now, the system is really it was developed in my laboratory when Konrad was a student there. He was highly involved in this. When he took the system, of course, with him, and he did this very nice experiment. The problem was a student in my laboratory did the same thing. And this was Bryce Carey and Stella Markulaki. When Bryce, when the paper came out, of course, I told Bryce, well, maybe you should stop. That was done. But dealing with MIT students, they don't listen to you. So he carried on. It was actually quite interesting because there were very subtle differences between his system and Conrad's system. And let me just define those. So the vector, which was generated by Mostolovsky at BU, was OCT4, is a polycistronic vector. OCT4 was separated by the next one's caliper by a 2A sequence, which allows a ribosome to initiate with full strength at the second gene. Then there's an iris, which lets the ribosome get off and then come on again to express the last two genes. The vector Bryce used, and he made this vector when he was rotating in my laboratory, has very few differences, but they're key. The sequence of the second and the third factor was reversed. He used two different 2A sequences. These 2A sequences come from aftoviruses. That's a really trick. And for good reason. He rejected this one and used this one because for reasons which he did during his rotation. And then he used also a 2A sequence for the last two. So these were the difference between the vectors. It's the only difference between these strains. Totally minor, we thought. And actually, I thought this was a better vector here for reasons which I want to go into. What he found was rather interesting. So he found when he looks at the expression of this imprinted locus, he found that most of the iPS cells, he got preserved perfect imprinting, and only minority lost it. And he can look at, by DNA analysis, that the ones who preserve, that have a characteristic HHG1 site here, I mean that one allele is unmethylated, one is methylated. It's exactly what you would expect for an imprinted locus. But those which lost imprinting lost the non-methylated band. So in this case, the majority, two-thirds, preserved imprinting. Very different from the other strain. And when you looked at chimera formation, there was no difference between those which lost imprinting and those which retained imprinting. And finally, this is a complicated slide, he looked at this tetraploid complementation, the most stringent assay, and already found that all of his iPS cells could make mice which went to birth. And those with the green bars say they could not establish breathing, which you see very often. They went because the lung is rather immature, so often they cannot. But the blue bars, they could establish breathing. And you can see most of them could. And actually, mice or iPS cells that lost imprinting could make pups which would breathe. So in this case, over a high fraction of Bryce's mice were for incompetent. And a very high fraction, actually, all of them, and most of them could establish breathing in the pups. And the final difference was sort of curious, that Conrad's mice developed tumors at a very rapid rate. It's very difficult to breed these mice, and he published this, but all mice never get tumors. So, obviously, what's the reason for this? I mean, it's identical systems. Vector expression, of course, that would be the first. We looked at this, and when you look just now at vector expression of SOX2 and OCT4 and the two different strains, either without doxycycline or with, there's just no difference. No difference. So these are the major differences. In the one strain, we have normal imprinting preserved in a small minority of cells. Here is a very high minority. Tumor incidence is 100% here, zero here, but vector expression is identical. So what's the basis for this? We scratched our heads. Let me remind you, the minor differences were the sequence in these vectors and the different choice of a 2A sequence. And then Bryce did the key experiment. He did a Western, and that was the answer. So you can see here in his strain, there was about a tenfold high expression of OCT4, whereas in Conrad's strain, there were these unprocessed precursor proteins and a 20-fold high expression of KLF4, and counter to expectation, SOX2 and MYC for high expression Conrad's and lower in our strain. So this would be the quantitation of this. So there were major differences in level and stoichiometry of protein expression. Stoichiometry is key here. Our strain, high OCT4 and high KLF4 levels, and in Conrad's strain, low OCT4 and lower KLF4 and higher CMYC and SOX2. So prediction would be, if you increase OCT4 and CMYC, you get better quality iPS cells. So we did that and asked the question, would we lower loss of imprinting? So in this case, we lost imprinting in 45% of the cells. You add OCT4 with the virus, no difference. You add KLF4, no difference. You add both, it goes down to a third. So additional OCT4 KLF4 reduces the loss of imprinting. Of course, the key issue, could we convert now the not-so-good cells of Conrad to something which is better by changing the stoichiometry? So the experiment was done, I will just summarize this. So this was this Conrad's mice taking somatic cells, get isogenic iPS cells, which have lost imprinting. 5% only retained it. We add now OCT4 and KLF4 with a virus, and we got these, depending on what you want, secondary or primary iPS, which overexpress OCT4, and when we look at GTA2 expression, well, it increased 20%, which is not dramatic, but at least somewhat. The question is, could you get it more uniform if you go to tertiary iPS cells? So you really select again for the right integration of your viruses you added. So this was the experiment I showed you, 5% you start with, you get 20% when you overexpress OCT4, but now we take a clone which has preserved imprinting and make no subclones of that one. By taking the cell, inject them again into a blastocyst, make a chimera, now getting secondary MEFs from that, and then getting tertiary iPS cells from that one. Ask the question, what is no? Because you went now through the bottleneck here. They have all the same viral integration pattern. And in this case, it was 60%. So in a way, it argued that indeed the stoichiometry, which you never can retrospectively determine what it is, affected the quality of iPS cells. So this would be the summary. It seems to be more optimal to have a high OCT4 KLF4 expression and have a low. Teratoma formation both can do. Chimera grade is higher here than here. 4N competence is very high. It's low here. And GTL2 expression is mostly normal. It's mostly loss of imprinting. So what are the conclusions? I think what this argue would that the quality of iPS depends on genetic background, of course, and the condition that are particularly for a given iPS such as vector integration. So this was identical in both strains. But the factor level expression, the effector protein expression, and the stoichiometry in the initial phase of reprogramming, that was the only difference. And I think this conclusion we can only draw because of a two very well-defined transgenic system which we could compare. So coming back, what is a good iPS cell? And can we define good iPS cells by these epigenetic studies? Is there a generic state of iPS cells? Or does the state of a given iPS cell depend on unique and I would call idiosyncratic circumstances of its isolation? It's always different for each cell. You can't predict. And can we optimize it? So these are questions which I think are unresolved and would like to look at. So genetically unmodified cells, no viral vectors, I think they're different strategies. Either vectors do not integrate or can be removed. I think that's a very successful strategy. I think very interesting is the introduction of factors as messenger RNA or small molecules. I think basically this is resolved, this issue. Could be made more effective, so I will not talk about this further. Genetic manipulation. I think that's a key issue because homologous recombination, as I said, is very inefficient in human ES cells. And so we were interested to use different approaches like zinc finger nucleases and telanucleases. So let me briefly go through this, what these procedures involve. Zinc fingers can bind to specific sequence when they're fused to pairs, when they're fused to one nuclease and they're dimerized, they induce a double strain break. which can give a mutation if you don't do anything else in incubating the cells. But if you give also a vector which has homology to the ends, this can integrate at this site. And so the question was, could this be used for genetically manipulating cells? Together with Sangamo, we did this, and I will just summarize, and it was in my laboratory, Dr. Kogemeyer, Frank Solner. We did it for these three genes first. So OCT4 is expressed in ES cells. Basically, every clone we got was targeted. AABS1, it's a really nice locus. It's ubiquitously expressed. It's a locus where we can add a transgene with predictable expression. And it's 50%. We use this a lot. And PITX3 is a silent gene. It's only expressed in the dopaminergic lineage. It's 10%. So this approach allowed efficient targeting of expressed and silent genes. And we have done it for quite a number of genes now. I think it works. There's one drawback here, which is the design of zinc fingers. You need really experts like Sangamo to give you those. We never designed those. It's complex. So the talents. Let me just go to the talents. It's really an incredible system which comes from plants. It's invented by plant pathogens. When they infect a plant, they have to either turn on genes or turn off genes. They do this by DNA binding proteins. And these are 30 amino acids, and two amino acids in the 30 amino acid repeat specify one base. So you can make just put these together, these arrays, and they bind to predetermined sequences. So we wanted to compare the TALEN approach with the zinc finger approach. And so we one example, the AABS1 locus, this expression locus, where the zinc fingers were designed to bind to these two sequences, and the cut was in the middle. The TALENs bound a little bit further apart, they're a little bit more bulky, and they bind here and they give a cut here. So what's the efficiency of these two systems? And the efficiency is, I think, remarkably similar. So the OCT4 is about 90% or more, AAV1 locus 50%, and PITX3 10 to 15%. So I think the zinc finger TALEN targeting approach is efficient. And we have done it now for quite a number of genes. You need short arms of homology. There's no need for isogenic vectors, and the off-target cleavage is very rare. And I think the interest for us is TALENs are easy to design. We can do it in 3 to 5 days in the lab. So it's not a complicated thing. So the main challenge is for disease modeling, I think, is in vitro relevant phenotypes. Let me briefly go through this. So clearly there's a number of in vitro phenotypes have been published, and I will not go through those. Which an in vitro phenotype has been seen, which is thought to reflect some parts of the disease. We are interested in Parkinson's, and we haven't seen any phenotype looking at differentiated iPS cells from a Parkinson patient. So this really reflects the problem of the field, namely Parkinson develops over decades, but of course in culture you don't have decades. You have weeks or months maybe, and you have to learn how to differentiate the cells and maybe expose them to in vitro stress situation to possibly telescope aging and maybe mimic the situation in vitro. So the key challenge is, and I want to come to my last point, what is the right control? So what do you compare whatever you find in your culture dish to what's the normal condition? Is it the difference you might find? Is a system immanent to the IPS-IPS variation? Or is it due to what you want to study? And of course, even healthy siblings may not be the right control. So what you want is isogenic pairs of cells, which differ exclusively at this one base pair, which gives you the disease. Right? And the IPS cells have to come from the same fibroblast because of stoichiometry issues I said before. So what you want to do is either introduce, correct the mutation in an IPS cell or insert the mutation into a wild-type IPS. So the key is you generate isogenic pairs of cells. So we're interested in Parkinson's, and we're interested in these two mutations, which give rise to point mutations, give rise to dominant point mutations, which give rise to early-onset Parkinson. And so we wanted to make cells which only differ at one of these or the other of these two point mutations. And so this would be either introducing mutation into wild IPS cells or correcting it into an IPS cell. Targeting strategies, or either vector, and I'm going to go into these, or actually using a vector, not a vector, but an oligo. And I want to just briefly go to this here. So we use an oligo. Here's a cut. And here's one mutation is here, one the other one is here. And really, it did work. And I will really not go into these the different strategies, but rather come to the conclusion here. The conclusion would be the oligo-based targeting is the most advantageous strategy to induce point mutation because you don't leave any footprint. There's no genetic alteration in this. It's a pristine cell which only has this point mutation. And so if you have those cells and you control cells, you could be rather confident if you find a phenotype that this is disease relevant. So the challenge for iPS cell based disease research, I think, is vector-free iPS cells, the quality, how do we assess quality of pluripotency, naive versus primed cells, criteria of pluripotency is very important, efficient genetic manipulation, I think isogenic controls for disease-specific iPS cells, and finally, I think the key unresolved issue is how do you get functional disease-relevant cells. So I'm running out of time, so I wanted to talk briefly about cell therapy and a proof of principle experiment. I will skip that because Roger gets very unresty. So I will just skip ahead and come to my final slide here, which is really... that was just... So coming to this slide here, which just... I think just making the point again that in this really scheme, disease modeling, I think, is really the most realistic way to do it if we solve these technical issues I talked about. I think cell therapy is probably we need to resolve much more, and one should be careful not to promise too much, I think, too much therapy which is around the corner. It may not be. So let me just finish with acknowledging the people who did all the work here in my laboratory. I alluded to those, Frank Solander, Kockemeyer, Hayo Wang, Chris Saha, Bryce Carey, Stella Markulaki, all of those were involved in the experiments. I mentioned them, collaborated with Rick Young. Jakob Hanna was highly involved in the experiments I talked about, and we had a very productive collaboration with Sangamo, particularly with Fyodor Ornov, and Phil Gregory is here at the meeting, on the zinc finger approaches. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I always get all the blame for this, don't I? Very quickly, this is where I start my exercises. If you actually have any questions, we can take about 3 questions. I'll run up and down, give you a mic. But you must put your hand up and you have to speak into the microphone, otherwise it will not go on the record. And Rusty Gage.
So, Rudy, the experiment comparing your vector with Conrad's, one of the bigger effects was the increase in tumorigenicity, and what was also clear was that MYC was overexpressed in his mice relative to yours. Did you resolve that?
Yeah, I think actually the tumor issue is a rather trivial one. No, in Conrad, you remember, iris sequence was driving SOX2 and MYC. No, this could be, of course, by a read-through from the collagen promoter, you could activate MYC. Whereas in our vector, everything was done from the tetracycline vector. So I believe there's just occasional read-through in the mice, and that it activates MYC that gives you a tumor. So it's, I think it's a rather trivial thing, which we haven't tested this, but I think it's rather trivial. But it makes these mice as difficult to keep. So that's a fun issue. So it looks like this polycystronic vector Bryce used is very tightly controlled. Apparently there's no activation in the animal of MYC.
Any more questions, or you're all just stunned by Rudy's erudition here? But right, okay. Keep it short.
In terms of looking at the differences between human embryonic stem cells and iPS cells in terms of their cytokine expression, have you actually looked at that to see
cytokine,
the differences?
Yes, no, cytokine. I mean, what's important is to realize in the Jamie Thompson protocol, FGF and activin is a key to make ES cells and to make iPS cells. So of course you end up with a prime state because cells react to what you in what environment they are. When you change that, and I didn't go into the conditions, then they're depending on LIF, but then the naive cells. It's like the human naive cells depend on LIF. So you switch the dependency on the different cytokines and probably some other issues, which then correspond to the most naive state.
Katrina Jameson at the back.
Takes a long time. So you mentioned that additional OCT4 and KLF4 reduces the loss of imprinting. What about the potential for microenvironmental modulation of reprogramming factor expression?
I think that might be very important. We don't know that. We haven't defined that. So clearly these ES cells can generate their own microenvironment, has been shown, and this could be very important for their propagation, for keeping their pluripotency. But certainly I don't think we really know concretely what these conditions are and how they're affected. So I think that needs to be defined.
Okay.